This is a lady that we had on the show several months ago, and you know how we wrap up every interview, and I always say, yeah, and I hope you'll come back and visit us again sometime. You know, it's sort of like you'd see somebody on Main Street, and you say, y'all come on over to the house now. You know, and they go, yeah, yeah. But we really meant it, and she really did want to come back, and so we're delighted to have her back this morning. So first up on the High Velocity Radio Show is a lady who is a best-selling author. She is a consultant to sales organizations, large and small, and has a very different take on this whole discipline of sales. Please welcome to the show once again, Sharon Drew Morgan. Good morning, Sharon Drew.
Good morning. And if you do want to learn how to eat properly, I'm your woman. I have a master's in health, and I've spent my whole life being healthy and eating healthy. And you're right, Todd. Get rid of all the processed food. And really, really seriously reduce the potatoes, corn, and bread because it's all sugar. And be careful with starchy stuff. And make sure you have lots and lots of good, and eat organic because otherwise you're putting a lot of chemicals in your body.
No, I understand that. Now, I'm a long-distance runner, so I need carbs for energy. So what do you recommend that I do?
They make some kinds of breads that they keep either in refrigerators. Bread has to be hard. Once bread is soft, you're just eating chemicals because they've taken all the good stuff out, which means 99% of the bread that they use is not good. But if you go to places like Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or any of those, they have really good breads, Ezekiel bread. You're the hard ones that have the good stuff in it. That's a good carb. And fresh butter. Not margarine. That's got too many chemicals. I eat no chemicals at all.
Well, that's great advice. I got to tell you, it's hard in this society to avoid those kinds of things.
I eat home a lot, and I always carry nuts, raw nuts. I always carry raw nuts with me.
Yeah, well, Stone, good news. There's a Trader Joe's on the way to and from the studio.
So. Okay. I know, and I love Trader Joe's, and we've got Fresh Market, and we've got a Whole Foods coming. All of it very close.
And you know something? One of the things that I just discovered is that you really have to eat every 3 hours.
Yeah, that's been the big adjustment for me is not three meals a day. It's five or six smaller meals a day.
That's right. And that's why I always carry nuts with me. I always have organic hot dogs here. If I'm in a rush, I could just put an organic hot dog.
That sounds like an oxymoron to me.
It's just the shape of it. It's really healthy inside. There's no chemicals. It's all natural. Hmm. And I always have roast beef or something.
Do they have brat flavored?
Say that again.
Do they have brat flavored organic hot dogs?
What kind of flavor?
Bratwurst. Brats.
Oh, yes, they do. Yeah, you can have an organic bratwurst.
Outstanding.
Sure.
Well, we got to stop by the Trader Joe's on the way in, Todd.
That's a good idea.
Well, listen, Sharon Drew, we have all been following your blog religiously since the last time we had you on the show, but I have to confess, last week got a little crazy for me. I've not seen your last post, but I understand that there were some ideas shared in that last post of yours that raised a few eyebrows. Can you tell us more about what you had to say?
I actually do four posts a week, just letting you know. Mondays I write about buying facilitation. Tuesdays are Cranky Tuesday. Thursday I write about other people and I write nice things about friends and books. And then Fridays I talk about business. But last Tuesday I did create a bit of an uproar because what I realized was that the sales field is really caring about the seller, not the solution and the product, and certainly not the buyer. See, that's pretty tough because here's why. The sales process has a focus only on the needs analysis, needs assessment, and solution placement, which means the salesperson, by definition, is outside of the buyer's system. So they're not part of the relationships and the stakeholder issues and the decisions they make, and they're not there when the tech team tries to take over, and they're not there when the two guys are in the men's room. Salespeople are outside, and the problem with sales is that it focuses on the need and acts as if that were an isolated event, totally forgetting that it's part of something bigger that maintains it every day. So salespeople continue their push to place solution, and throughout time, whether it's been Dale Carnegie, or whether it's been Linda Richardson, who is the founder of Consultative Sales, or Spin, or or high prob or a solution selling or a sailor, they all are based on placing solution. And no matter what people use, they have less than a 10% close rate. Think about that. There's nothing in the world that allows for a less than 10% success rate and calls it successful.
Right. No, they fire you before lunch if you hit 100.
if you go to a dentist that says, we have a 7% success rate, yay. You wouldn't hire a baseball player.
That's right.
Well, baseball players are Hall of Fame if they're 30% successful.
That's right.
But those are Hall of Famers.
That's right. But it's still not 10% or 7% or 2%. I just had a person I bought my guided study program because she wanted to learn on her own. She was the COO of a small franchise company, and she had all of her franchisees from the Spanish-speaking countries in last week and asked me to speak with them because she wanted them to learn buying facilitation. And they sat for an hour and a half and defended what they're doing, and they have a 2% close rate. That's 2. And they were defending a 98% failure rate. And I got off the phone, and I scratched my head. I said, what the hell was that? And I kept saying things like, so what I hear you saying is that you're really good at needs analysis and solution placement. What has stopped you from getting a higher close rate? Well, because the buyer is stupid. Well, so the whole field has enabled failure. Imagine if the sales field said, you have to close 30% of sale. Otherwise, you're fired.
Right.
We pay them more. We pay them battle pay for 5% success. And they waste 90% of their time and their employer's time. They don't get the product out. Because salespeople are doing what salespeople enjoy doing, finagling and maneuvering and manipulating and persuading and having all kinds of fun with their personalities, but they ain't selling shit. They're just not selling anything. So think about it. I mean, whose fault is that? It's the entire field of sales that's enabling failure.
So how do you turn it around? What do you change? How do you improve something like that?
Well, of course I have the answer.
Of course, we figured.
Of course. Be nice, Todd. Be nice. I've developed buying facilitation, and people ought to take a look at my new book, Dirty Little Secrets, because this is all discussed in there. But the buying facilitation is a decision facilitation model that works with the inside end of what's going on with the stakeholders and the buyer. So while we can't be there with them because we're not them, it's a different skill set. It's a change management model. So I teach the buyer what they would need to be doing to get their stakeholders together and how they would know that they're following a path of success. What would their stakeholders need to be doing differently to be willing to make a change? What would buy-in look like if it was succeeding? How would they know when it was time to bring something new in versus continue doing what they were doing? What's stopping their old vendor from coming in if they have a partial success? I teach them how to manage all the decisions they have to make. They have to make them anyway, right?
Right.
They're going to do it with me or without me.
Right.
I got a call from one of the largest banks in the world in Europe, and they asked me if I could add this new front end to what this little piece of technology, a big piece of technology they were creating to help buyers make buying decisions. And instead of going, oh, yippee, let me start doing a proposal, thinking in my systems GPS mind, I got very curious. So this is the largest bank in the world, and they're calling me to do a front end technology. There's something wrong with that picture. So I said to them, oh, that sounds like a lot of fun. What is stopping your tech group from wanting to learn my material and do it for you themselves? And the guy said, good question. That is the problem, of course. They're busily reading your books and trying to do it themselves, but I don't think they can. So would you fight the good fight with me?
I mean, that is a marvelous question, and I'll tell you, you and I, of course, over the months have developed quite a friendship and have had some pretty involved conversations, and you've been so gracious in trying to help me think through some of our sales challenges here at High Velocity. And one of the things that I picked up on is you will ask a series of questions that really help me examine with a great deal more clarity and objectivity what my challenge is, what my role is in that challenge, and what to do about it. Can you share with us, is there a specific priority and sequence to these questions, or is it something that you just know to ask because you've been doing it for so long?
Well, I have a nonverbal learning disorder, which is a high-end form of Asperger's. So my brain does this naturally, but I have spent my life figuring out how to break it into pieces so that I can replicate it and teach other people how to do it. But one of the things that you'll notice about, and there is a system, I'll try to walk you through it a little bit. Dirty Little Secrets, the new book, does go through the whole thing, actually. One of the things you notice with my questions is that they're not biased.
No, they're not. They're really not.
They really help you. The normal questions help me gather data. Why do you do that? Helps me. What did you do before now? Helps me. But if I said, what has stopped you from having more success than you're currently experiencing until now? What would you need to know or believe differently to be willing to look at this in a new way that might be uncomfortable at first? So I'm teaching you, there's actually a sequence to how decisions get made. I've coded this sequence. And I can use these facilitative questions that are non-biased to help you go through your own decision-making procedure and discover the conscious and unconscious things that you need to know differently in order to make a decision that's different. One of the problems with sales is that we treat the need as if it were an isolated event and forget that it's all part of a system. When I talked to, I might have told this story the last time, but I think it's worth repeating, working with a client in Edinburgh, and he got a prospect that called to say no thank you to a series of three trials I'd already done over 11 months. So my client asked me to call to find out what was going on. Now, if it was a price issue, they would have known even before the first trial. They would have known in week two, not 11 months later. If it was a solution problem, they would have known after the first trial or the second trial. Certainly by the third trial, they knew what the solution was. So I don't know what's going on. Other salespeople might have called and said, hi, Linda, I've got a good price for you. See if this works better. But it wasn't a price issue. It's almost never a price issue. I called her up and I said, you must have been so sad to have to turn down this solution. And she said, oh, I was. I love your solution so much. And I said, what stopped you from being able to buy it? And she said, there's an HR guy who's here now, and he's my business partner here. And he's contentious and mean, and every time I deal with him, I get a migraine, and I have to stay home the next day. So I have stopped dealing with him, and since he's the head of HR and I'm the head of L&D, we'd have to work together on this, and I'm not working with him. So I said, and I went into buying facilitation. I said, so it sounds like you've chosen to use your personal feelings as your primary filter to look through and have put the employee's needs second. And she said, oh, my God, I did that. That's what I did. That's what I did. And I said, so what would you need to know or believe or have differently to enable you to figure out a way to talk with this guy just in case there are tools that your employees need and the two of you have to figure it out together? And she said, I'll call you back. And she wrote back and said, can I have some of those questions? So I gave her some facilitative questions, and 2 days later they called and they closed the deal.
What a story. That is so cool. A couple of things that I observe in that. One is your willingness to to be candid, to call a spade and get the real issue out on the table. The other thing that I pick up in this conversation and I've experienced personally, when you ask one of those hard questions, you let some space occur and you wait for an answer, you know, because it takes a person a minute or two to really think that through and come up with an answer.
What I do with those facilitative questions is I take three or four of the indices of where memories and thoughts are stored. I use brain function. And I teach the brain how to put together all of the issues that it needs to consider. And I do it one step at a time. It's not a normal question of gathering data because I'm actually directing you. It's the difference between, let's say, why do you wear your hair like that, which pulls data of a decision you've already made, and I get to know the answer of your decision, versus how would you know if it were time to reconsider your hairstyle? So I'm teaching you how to think new thoughts. See, we don't know how we're going to change, because change means we're going to disrupt our system. And that's what salespeople do with their new product, with their solution. They're disrupting the buyer. And until or unless the buyer figures out how to manage all those internal little bits and the people and the policies and relationships, until the buyer knows how to manage all the internal stuff, they can't take the risk of disruption, so they wait. So they have to do this stuff anyway. So with my facilitation model, I teach the buyer how to go through all of those offline, behind-the-scenes decisions that they have to address. Anyway, salespeople sit in their desk and wait for them to do it anyway. So I'm either going to be part of the process or I'm going to sit and pick my nose while the buyer does it. It has to get done anyway. You wouldn't buy a house walking down the street seeing a new house that you liked and then going in and giving them a check for $100,000 and then going home to your wife and saying, hey, I just bought a new house. We're moving tomorrow. You would never do that because there's a system involved. If I said to you, you've got an extra 10 pounds on you, what has stopped you until now from wanting to do something about it? Todd, it seems like you're doing something about your health now, but it has maintained itself and stayed the same through time until the day came when you decided you were going to have to do something different. You were going to have to buy new sneakers. You were going to have to put an hour away aside every other day. You were going to have to change your food. There was a whole series of decisions that you had to make. It wasn't about the gym membership, right? The running was the last thing you did, not the first thing you did.
Well, I just wanted to look good naked.
I'm not going to go there. I'm a single woman. Don't go there with me. I like to see a single man naked every once in a while. So what I've done is I've created a model that first does a change management routine to help the buyer manage all the internal stuff, and then you sell. So that's why I want to go back to what the sales model. The sales model maintains itself like a system does, and it has accepted and enables failure.
Well, Sharon, Drew, that's the... I'm sorry.
What? I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to ask this question. One of the points you make is that sellers in the sales process, they continue to do what they've always done, and they're not learning new ways. They're not learning new styles. And they're continuing to be mired in these low close rates. We have a business partner at High Velocity, and he's a real big advocate of sales process engineering. And he was doing a presentation to a bunch of salespeople. And I think we'd all agree there's some great blogs out there about how to improve your selling, and including yours, for example. But he was asking these guys, how many of you read a bunch of sales blogs and follow them in your RSS reader? Let me show of hands, and just like two or three guys in this whole room raised their hand, and so most of these guys aren't learning. Now my question to you is, why is that happening? Is it a lazy salesperson, or is it the culture they're in?
I'm going to tell you why. It's all part of the same thing. It's all part of the exact same thing I'm talking about. The sales process is focused on the identity of the salesperson. I wrote a blog post last Tuesday called "Why Do Salespeople Like to Fail." And I'm writing one today that's similar about the job of the salesperson. The job of sales is so mired in rejection and failure that it has come down to the skills of the salesperson. There's a statistic that something like 85% of the salespeople say they've invented their selling modality themselves, okay? Because it's all the same. This open, close, pitch, rejection, money, it's all been the same for the last 100 or so or more years. So the sales model is all about the seller's identity, which is why they can push back when they have a 2% close rate, because it's about me and everybody else is stupid. Once the sales model says, wait a minute, you can be as stupid as you want, you can be as unsuccessful as you want, but then I'm gonna fire you. The sales model enables the salesperson, because the sales model, the statistical average of trying to help 100 buyers to buy and having a 7% close rate, it's not even a statistical average. It's below. So the salespeople are involved internally, in their guts. It's who they are. So we're asking not just the sales model per se to change, but we're asking salespeople to change who they are. And they are a system that has maintained itself through time and maintains its bad habits through time. If the sales profession said, wait, that is no longer okay, I am now going to demand a 35 or 40%. Now the salespeople go, oh my goodness, now I have to change. Now I'm going to have to add something different. Okay? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So what does all this mean for the sales manager, for the sales leader who is responsible for generating results with and through other people?
So either they're going to have to maintain industry average. I recently had somebody stand up an extra 2 inches and say, I have a 15% close rate. I go, good, you're only wasting 85% of your time. Shut up. So the sales manager is either going to have to call me, which is what sales managers sometimes do, or they're going to have to really start recognizing the difference between the needs assessment and solution placement, which is what sales do, and then look around for some kind of a change management model to help buyers manage the internal stuff. It's a different skill set. I call it like being a GPS system. So first I teach the buyer how to buy in to being willing to change and what that would look like and who has to be involved and why and how. And then once they're open to that, then they know exactly where to place my solution and how to fix their need. So have the sales manager say, this isn't okay. Stop enabling and paying them. I mean, everyone in the whole company gets mad at the salespeople because they have a 2% close and they get paid twice as much as everybody else for failing. This makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, so, go ahead.
No, you finish.
No, my recommendation is that they do both, that they certainly try to get their arms around this, but I think they also ought to get in contact with you. I think there's a tremendous amount to learn from your book and your other work. What's the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you, learn more about your work, and really start to turn things around in this regard?
NewSalesParadigm.com is a site. My blog, which is kind of cool, I think. Don't you think? I think so.
I think so.
She says modestly. I'm sorry. My modesty factor is zero. SharonDrewMorgan.com. Go to DirtyLittleSecretsBook.com. That's about my new book, Why Buyers Can't Buy and Sellers Can't Sell and What You Can Do About It. And it's a whole book on how the buyer goes through their changes internally. And there's a great case study at the end that shows the sale from every angle and what's happening and why and so forth. So DirtyLittleSecretsBook.com, SharonDrewMorgan.com, and NewSalesParadigm.com talks about the model itself, the buying facilitation model.
Well, Sharon Drew, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show again, and now you know that we really mean it. We want you to come back again and talk some more before too long.
Thank you. Bye, everybody. Good luck, Todd. Any questions with your diet, email me.
I absolutely will. Thanks for that.
Bye-bye, Sharon Drew. Bye. Thanks. Well, that was a fun interview. That's an insightful lady, huh?
Oh, she's always fun to spend time with.
Well, and she'll tell you how it is, or at least she'll tell you how she thinks
it is.
Well,
I think we need more of that. There's just not enough of that. I think
the marketers out there that are succeeding are the ones that are being bold and frank and telling you what you need to hear. And your success or failure from getting that kind of frank advice is whether you listen or not. And it just seems the majority of people still aren't listening.
Well, you know, and we're all searching for that point of differentiation. I got to say, I genuinely believe that just being candid with a client or prospect this day and age, it is a point of differentiation, because you got a lot of folks out there dancing and not wanting to hurt feelings and walking on eggshells and all that. I mean, you need to have the skill and insight and empathy and intellect and knowledge base to call it proper. But once you have all those in place, I think we owe it to the client to just tell the truth.
Yeah, well, and you hope then, as I said, that they listen to that. And a lot of them still don't.
Well, until next time, this is Stone Payton, Todd Schnick, our producer Lee Cantor, and everyone here at the Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.